You must tell me all your secrets. Remember, we must share everything together.
Mind of David Lynch comes a modern-day masterpiece, so startling, so provocative, so mysterious, that it will open your eyes to a world you have never seen before.
She wore blue velvet, but in my heart there'll always be precious and warm a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet.
Hey, neighbor. Here I come. You got about 1 second to live, buddy.
Through my tears, your blue velvet, oh, oh, bluer than velvet was the night, oh, 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 softer than satin was the light. From the stars. But oh, she wore blue velvet. Oh, oh, bluer than velvet were her eyes. Warmer than May her tender sighs. Love was ours, ours. Love I held tightly, feeling the rapture grow. Like a flame burning brightly. But when she left, gone was the glow of blue velvet. Oh, no. But in my heart there'll always be precious and warm a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
One more verse, here we go.
She wore blue velvet. But in my heart there'll always be,
oh, oh,
precious and warm a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
You're listening to Girls, Guts, and Giallo, and this is Annie Rose Malamet. And today, we are talking about one of my most highly requested films. I've been doing this podcast for almost 5 years in April. Crazy.
Wow.
And this is an episode that people will leave comments about on Apple Podcasts asking me to do it. And I'm here today with the perfect person to do this episode with. They're in a blue velvet hoodie from the synagogue.
That's right. Shout out.
C-I-N-E.
Instagram, as it were.
L'chaim.
Mazel.
I'm here with the one and only, my partner, my it, my baby girl.
That's right.
Car Conaway.
Hi, mommy.
Hi, Car. And I don't like to talk about my personal life too much on the podcast, but I do want you guys to know that I am polyamorous and Tashina and I are still together. Don't get ideas.
Don't get it twisted.
Don't get it twisted.
Tashina's in the other room right now.
She's literally in the other room. Yeah, with Honey, my dog Honey. And she is generously giving us the space to record this episode.
Yes, indeed.
So I say I don't talk about my personal life that much, but I do like to talk about my personal experiences with the movies. Mm. But before we get into that, Carr, can you introduce my listeners to who you are? What's your whole deal? What are you about?
Yeah. Well, I'm Carr Conaway. Thank you so much for that little intro, Mommy. I will be referring to you as Mommy throughout the episode. For the listeners at home, that's my real mother. We're biologically related. I'm a leather dyke. I'm a filmmaker, musician. I'm a butler, and I'm an all-around boy girl. I work in the film industry in the Bay, and I've also been a listener of Girls, Guts, and Giallo for quite some time. And I was actually a listener before we met, which is how we met. In fact, I went to one of Annie's screenings, and from there, I was just picked up and kidnapped, and that's actually kind of it.
And that's the episode. Yeah, she approached me the way that you should, which is with deference and respect.
And it's so funny seeing just how many don't. It's really shocking, actually.
It takes money to talk to Mommy.
It takes money to talk to Mommy, and I brought you $3,000. Just kidding, just a little cheeky smile. That was all I had.
So today we are talking about David Lynch's very famous 1986 film, Blue Velvet. And I've been very intimidated to talk about any David Lynch movie on this podcast because he is so beloved. If I get something wrong or I don't, you don't like something I say or my interpretation, the stakes are high because he is such a beloved filmmaker. And I think I've just been really intimidated.
For sure.
So I'm excited to get to do this episode with somebody I trust so much. And it's calming my nerves.
Oh, good. Well, you know what? If anything goes wrong, if you say anything, if any of you listeners hear anything you don't like, just blame it on me.
Blame it on
the butler.
The butler.
It's all good. It's all my fault, obviously.
So I like to start the episode off, Carr, usually, as you know, from being a listener, with our first experiences with the film.
Yeah.
So what was your first experience with Blue Velvet and why do you love it?
Well, I first saw Blue Velvet when I was in high school, and I was shown it to me by a group of friends. I worked at a movie theater when I was in high school, so I was like a longtime movie theater worker. That was like my whole personality sort of thing. I started working at this like art house theater when I was 15, California Film Institute, and I had this group of older punk friends that like really took me in. And when they showed this to me, I was like, oh, my life is forever changed. Like,
totally.
It really struck me. It really disturbed me when I first saw it. And I saw it in like a very nasty, crusty punk house on VHS. People were just doing drugs around me. It was a perfect setting, actually, to watch this movie in for the first time. And I had like just watched Twin Peaks, so like I was just learning who David Lynch was. And yeah, I was extremely disturbed when I first watched it. And I still feel that kind of sense of anxiety when I watch this movie. And now I can sexualize it, and it's great.
Yeah, I was disturbed when I first saw this movie, but my world was also opened up.
Yeah.
I first saw it in middle school. Mm. I think my dad rented it or something, and I watched it by myself. But I remember there was this documentary back in the day on the Turner Classic Movies channel about sex in film. Mm. And there was this clip from Blue Velvet, and it's the clip where Dorothy Valens and Jeffrey are naked in bed, and she's asking him to hit her.
Mm.
And I was just so intrigued. And when I saw the movie, it was kind of like, because we're of a certain generation,
mm-hmm.
it was really my first exposure to weird movies.
Yeah.
And then later in like eighth grade and high school, I would become a very hardcore cult movie fan.
Hmm.
But it was my first exposure to this kind of film. And it was so, I didn't quite understand everything I was watching at the time because I was so young, but it's indelible. Like the images were just burned into my brain and it became a gold standard for me of how I wanted to feel when I watch a movie, which is deeply disturbed and captivated.
Yeah.
And that is how I love to feel when I'm watching film.
Totally. That I feel very similarly with this movie. Like it wasn't just that it was disturbing. It was that it was so like, there's parts of this movie that are so like, they're just so bizarre that you're like, it's like watching a car crash. You're like, yes, yes. And like you're hearing all these things, and you're also putting this mystery together with Jeffrey and
mysteries of love.
And Angelo Badalamenti. Yeah. Andrew Badalamenti. it's just such a, it's so its own world. And it's so like kitschy in this way that really just, it's so fun. And then it packs such a punch. I find it to be like just so alluring.
It really distills a lot of David Lynch's whole thing too in this early movie.
Yeah.
Of his. It really, you know, he had already done Eraserhead, obviously, and The Elephant Man and Dune.
Yeah.
And I consider Blue Velvet really kind of the most, like, it takes so many themes and motifs from his entire body of work, and it's all in this one film.
Yeah.
The text that I'm using today, I'm using a few, but the big text I'm using today is the book about Blue Velvet by Michael Atkinson that was published through BFI that was written in 1997. So I'm going to be referencing that a lot throughout the episode. And he said that, "I saw the film on opening night in a crowded suburban Long Island theater where the unsuspecting middle-class audience, apparently lured by laudatory reviews, practically rioted. Uncomfortable laughter and disoriented conversation quickly gave way to angry shouting, hurled objects at the screen, and more walkouts than I'd ever seen before or since."
Wow.
It's the kind of shit we love on this podcast, right? If middle class suburbia hates it, like, we got to talk about the movie.
We're in. Hacker voice, I'm in.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's get into the production history a little bit. So Carr and I watched a lot of supplementary materials about this movie. I feel like we've been in Blue Velvet mode for weeks.
For like months.
Which is a part of what I love about doing this podcast is I get to go really deep into a movie. And, you know, for the past 5 years, the format has been, we explore one movie per episode for main episodes, and then the bonus episodes are kind of extra, like whatever else I want to talk about. But this is really my bread and butter, talking about one movie and getting really, really into it. And I can't believe I used to do this podcast weekly.
Jesus Christ.
And I would spend a lot less time with the films. And now that I release one main episode a month, I get to spend so much time with one movie. I feel like I just know it inside and out. I've just watched this movie like 4 or 5 times in the past couple of days.
Yeah.
So this movie started for David Lynch with the song Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton from 1964, which you heard a beautiful rendition.
It was excellent, wasn't it?
The top of the episode. You loved it, didn't you?
You fucking loved it.
Fucking loved it. Lynch had this idea for this mystery in a small city in a quiet neighborhood. And he also had this desire, he said, to sneak into a girl's room and watch her throughout the night and find a clue to a mystery.
Funny enough, so did I.
And that's why we, as dykes, as perverted dykes, often relate to these creepy directors so much. Because same dude.
Ugh, solid gold.
Yeah, so apparently David Lynch is very kind of like Boy Scout. And in the documentary we watched about the making of this movie, the actors were laughing because they were saying that when he kind of won't, he doesn't like to curse too much. And he also will say things when the actors are doing a good job. He'll be like, peachy keen.
Solid gold. I also just love that Dennis Hopper was talking about in that documentary how David Lynch would be like telling him about, you know, talking about the line read, whatever it was. And he's like, so when you say that word, and Dennis Hopper's like, when I say like, you fucking fuck, you fucker, you fuck, you fucking fuck, he like would be like, yeah, that word. Peachy keen.
Which is really funny because I actually saw a clip on Twitter today of David Lynch saying fuck because he got really frustrated because the producer on a set, I don't know which movie it was, but a producer was saying that a scene was too long. And he was like, who gives a fuck if it's too long?
He got older.
Yeah, he got older and surlier.
And the film got worse, but anyway, continue.
There were four drafts of the script over several years. Lynch actually had the idea for this movie since the late 1970s.
Oh, wow.
Dino De Laurentiis and David Lynch made Dune, and they almost parted ways because Dune was a flop. Lynch wanted final cut of this movie. That was his big sticking point. Dino De Laurentiis couldn't put that in the contract, but he made a verbal agreement that David Lynch would get the final cut of this movie. But there's actually a lot of deleted scenes. There, what is it, like over an hour?
It's 53 minutes.
53 minutes of deleted scenes if you have the Criterion edition. We watched the deleted scenes. We'll talk about some of them. So Lynch cast Kyle MacLachlan because he's kind of this like perfect, he's got this all-American Clark Kent type face, right? He's like the perfect Boy Scout. But of course, he's also this projection of David Lynch.
Even the way he dresses.
He dresses. That was something I was going to mention when we get into the film itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got this strange black suit on and an earring.
Oh, yeah. The little gay earring on the
little
left.
Little gay earring.
David knew.
He knew.
Do you think so? I think he did. He hung out in certain crowds. He dated Isabella Rossellini, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Sexy mommy.
I love how gay people will be like, that man dated this beautiful, sexy woman. Gotta be gay.
Literally.
I mean, it's the gayest thing a man could do.
Literally, is date a beautiful, gorgeous woman.
So Lynch originally asked Isabella Rossellini to put him in touch with Helen Mirren for the role of Dorothy Valens. But after having dinner together, David sent her a note asking Isabella to try out for the role. And of course, later they would actually date.
Yeah.
She had only done one film. She was not much of an actor yet. She was known for being the daughter of Ingrid Bergman and Roberto Rossellini.
Legendary.
Legendary.
Both of them.
Legendary pedigree. She had a career as a model at that point. Laura Dern was only 18. And she's the daughter of Bruce Dern and Diane Ladd, so also pedigree, of course. So the way Dennis Hopper comes to be cast, he's recovering from, at this time in, you know, the mid-80s, he's recovering from addiction. Dennis Hopper was a darling of the new Hollywood movement of the 1970s. He directed the countercultural classic Easy Rider. This was kind of his comeback after taking some time away.
Yeah, it was his first film since being in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And you can goddamn tell. In the best way possible,
yeah,
really. I'm like,
absolutely.
There's energy there.
Feverish performance.
Indeed.
Hopper, there's this incident that Carr and I really love where David Lynch is at a diner with the cast, with Isabella Rossellini and Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan. and Dennis Hopper calls him.
The big boys?
I think it was big boys.
Yeah.
And Dennis Hopper calls the big boys, and David Lynch gets on the phone with him, and Dennis Hopper says, I don't just want to play Frank Booth. I am Frank Booth.
Frightening proposition.
Yeah. And David Lynch goes back to the table, and he says, that's great for the picture, but I don't know how we'll ever have lunch with him.
Peachy Keen.
Peachy Keen. David Lynch was a painter before he was a filmmaker. I feel like that's an important detail. Probably David Lynch fans already know all of that, but he goes to painting school in Salzburg. He comes back to Philly, and he's inspired by the grittiness of Philly.
I love that that's what he said about Salzburg, too, that he mentioned in that documentary. He was like, in Salzburg, I felt uninspired. It was so clean and beautiful and, like, well-kept. And then he comes back to Philly. He's like, oh, yes, the garbage, the earth, the dearth. Like, he loves all the grittiness, which makes perfect sense for someone like him.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Carr, in your mind, what characterizes a David Lynch film?
Ooh, that's a really, it's a great question. I think he's so uncategorizable, And yet so specific. And that's why we have, like, the term Lynchian, I feel like. Because he's not, like, most of his work doesn't fit into the strict horror genre, doesn't fit into a strict drama category. I would say, like, The Elephant Man probably does, but there's elements of horror.
And the beginning and the end of The Elephant Man is decidedly Lynchian, quite surreal.
Yeah, I feel like surrealism and a level of experimental film, you can really tell he has an experimental film background too, which I love, this, like, non-narrative structure sometimes creeps in, and, like, he's notorious for not categorizing his films. And I think that's part of what is, like, a hallmark for him is this, there's elements of surrealism always, there's always dreamlike qualities to his work, or something not based in reality. There's a twisting of reality. And like Lost Highway, I mean, you could really, like, every film of his, every work of his stretches reality in this way. His characters are specifically, they'll talk in ways that you wouldn't normally kind of have, which I love because it plays into this, like, old Hollywood tradition of just having people talk insanely and not in a real way. It's a show. What you're watching isn't real. And I like that he almost always acknowledges that what he's engaging in is a work of fiction.
He loves artifice.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think the reason that a lot of people associate his work with surrealism is this focus on the subconscious and the unconscious. David Lynch in particular is very interested in the mundane. Mm. He's interested in the abstract image and distortion. Isabella Rossellini says that he exudes what he feels instead of articulating.
Mm.
Laura Dern also said he would have directions like, I want you to come in like a wind.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a sensory creature.
I wonder what he's like as a partner.
Yeah, I've often wondered that. There's this confusion and darkness and contortions are very fascinating to David Lynch. His work is often described as surrealist, but Michael Atkinson says Lynch's imagery is far from what is manifestly defined as surrealist, which in its truest uncommodified form is pathmarked by a sociological absurdism. Mm. That is, it retains power only as it roasts bourgeois desires and mocks social taboos.
Mm.
I think it's arguable if Lynch does that or not. I don't, you know, is Lynch surreal? I think is a question that people debate all the time.
Mm. Well, in that same vein, you could ask, it's like, well, does surrealism then kind of, are we basing that on, like, some level of pretension? Because you could argue the same for, like, a John Waters movie. Like, every John Waters movie has surrealist elements, quote unquote.
Well, the surrealist movement influenced experimental film greatly.
Totally.
Like, you can't really talk about it without talking about the surrealist movement.
Yes.
Like, the interest in the subconscious and dreams
mm-hmm.
is a big part of contemporary's experimental film.
Yeah, totally.
Anywhere from like Maya Deren to something like Bertrand Mandico's films, like their surrealism is an influence, whether the films themselves are pure surrealism or not.
Mm.
Michael Atkinson also says, perhaps cinema as an experience is already too deeply soaked in subconscious spirits to support willful irrationality as a principle, which may be why dreams in films always seem silly and redundant, which is a great point. But Lynch always manages to avoid that trap. Part of what makes him so compelling as a filmmaker is that he can portray the subconscious and the dream state without it being hacky.
Right. And then he all woke up and it was a dream. That just is never the case. You kind of don't know whether or not it's a dream or not, which is why I feel like he avoids that
pitfall. And usually when you say that, it's like, oh, we don't know if it's a dream. But Lynch never feels like that.
Yeah.
Which is really difficult to accomplish.
Totally.
And he's one of the only filmmakers that can and does do it well.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that. He's also just like a fantastical filmmaker. He's into these like very fun high art things. He's also into, I'm sure we'll talk about this more in this episode, but his like obsession with the Wizard of Oz, for instance. Like, he's playful, he's playing. Like, that's what the sense I get a lot in these films, is he's playing with these ideas and he's playing with these like theatrical concepts, motifs, movements, and then it's peppered in with all of his story. You know, it's like, it's the Glenda the Good Witch coming down in a bubble.
Wild at Heart.
And Wild at Heart. Yeah. She came down in a bubble, dog.
She was a witch!
You're gonna tell me I'm wrong? Grow up. He just loves these fantastical elements, and it's so fun to watch, truly. And I don't question whether or not it's a dream. I feel like
I'm, if you're along for the ride,
like if you're a fan of David Lynch, like, you just let it wash over you, and you're like, oh yes,
give me more.
I'm in the mystical highway. I'm lost.
Yeah,
it feels good.
Yeah, I have another quote here from Michael Atkinson that I really like, just because it mentions Sod, and we just did Sod for my Patreon. You guys really got to join my Patreon. If you're not on there yet and you're listening to this free episode, patreon.com/girlsgutsjallo. Support me. I do that. This is my life's work. This is all I do.
She's so incredible.
I work so hard.
You're a loser if you're not a subscriber. I
work so hard. And please support your girl.
Support my mother, please.
Yeah, we just did 3 months of Sod over on my Patreon. We watched movies with representations of Sod, and we read some Sod. So Michael Atkinson says, Lynch's vision often seems genuinely a priori. And though Blue Velvet could be categorized as a fetishistic neo-noir, or an absurdist Hardy Boys mystery, or a Sod-inflected buildings film, or an interrogation of post-war middle America, as well as a lurid Oedipal struggle, it most often seems to have crawled fully formed from Lynch's damp and ill-lit brain pan. It does feel like that. The films are fully formed out of his head.
From that same article, Atkinson quoted Barry Gifford, who wrote the book Wild at Heart, which was later adapted into a screenplay by David Lynch. He wrote that Blue Velvet was a phlegm noir, one cut above a snuff film, and referred to Lynch as a pornographic fabulist, which I thought was so chic.
Right, I know. He's like roasting him, and we're like, oh, yeah,
like
pornographic fabulous.
I'm like, oh, rare.
But it, you know, this was, he said that before Lynch had adapted Wild at Heart. It'd be interesting to hear what he would think after that. This film was received generally well. Pauline Kael wrote, this is American darkness, darkness in color, darkness with a happy ending. Lynch might turn out to be the first populist surrealist, a Frank Capra of dream logic.
Yeah.
But Roger Ebert didn't like it.
Of course.
He said, the movie is pulled so violently in opposite directions that it pulls itself apart.
You're like, okay, so do you when you're, I don't know, jerking off in your fucking bed with Siskel. I'm like, you're pulling yourself apart right now, brother. Rest in peace.
But I love that he got all these bad reviews, too, from like...
Yes, feminists hated this movie, too.
Feminists did?
Yeah.
Well, notoriously, we are not feminists here. Just kidding. Entirely kidding. But that
is... I never identify with other feminists on this podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm always... And I'm somebody... I'm retro. I still consider myself a feminist.
Yeah.
Even though feminism is in its flop era.
It really is.
As the kids say.
Yeah.
We need to bring it back, man. The trad wife wave right Dude. Now. I don't even want to get into it, but...
You know, we need a new branch of feminism that is, well, it's really just a new branch of feminism that's only misandrist, because truly that's my brand of feminism. It's just full out man-hating dykes. Can that be its own category? You know,
love who are perverts and love perverts.
Exactly.
And I think we're going to definitely talk about some of those scenes that feminists at the time, feminist writers really took issue with.
Mm.
So let's get into the film. We're going to do a beat by beat analysis, as is the basis of Girls, Guts, and Giallo. I've been missing this so much. I haven't done a main episode in a minute since Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, such a good episode.
Oh, that one was fun.
Shout out Travis.
Hi, Travis. So we open with these crushed blue velvet curtains, Angelo Badalamenti score, and we've got these beautiful cursive titles over this fabric.
It's waving.
Waving. It's like the opening of a Douglas Sirk melodrama or noir.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut to these picket fence, white picket fences, roses, gorgeous, oversaturated American suburb with Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton.
Gorgeous. It is. Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton, and you and I actually do the harmonies in that. We were both born at the time. We were there when it was recorded.
That's us.
That's us.
You guys, trivia.
Fun fact. That was us.
It's very idyllic, right?
Yeah.
There's this fireman waving from the truck, which
the
is
the Dalmatian on
the
it.
The Dalmatian, the Lumberton, which is the little town that this movie takes place in, was a real town in North Carolina. It was near where they shot on location in Wilmington. And do you think that this being shot on location, what does it add to the film to you as somebody who's in production?
Yeah, well, I mean, it definitely, Lynch talks about that in that documentary as well. Like
the documentary we keep referencing, by the way, is called Mysteries of Love.
Mysteries of Love,
and
yes.
It's on the Criterion edition of Blue Velvet.
Great documentary, provided a lot of insight, as well as those cutscenes. I think that he talked about how, you know, you step into people's homes and it's already... the amount of detail that's already there in a town like that, a small town in, you know, rural-ish America, like it adds this specific je ne sais quoi that you really, it's very difficult to recreate with any kind of production design. So you already have this immediate charm and this immediate place setting, and just shooting it on location, like a movie like this, if it were shot in Hollywood, would have, you know, I think it would just not, it doesn't have that kind of real charm necessarily, like even like the trees that we see in throughout the film, the actual like physical land setting is so of the place. And you really can't recreate that. I mean, you can, but you'd need a much larger budget. And at the time, I think this was shot on, it was under 10 million. Like it was a pretty small ish budget. Remember $10 million movies, you guys? It's really good stuff. I miss that.
We miss it.
We really miss it.
Yeah. And something we were talking about while we were watching this together was, you know, David Lynch is so obsessed with lumber.
So much lumber.
And what I found out, which I had no idea.
Yeah.
Actually, was that his father was a woodsman. And Lynch grew up in lumber towns. And this figures heavily into something like Twin Peaks.
Mm. Lumber as this representative of the like the dead American dream, like how the industry sort of guts these towns.
Totally.
It's very sinister. It's very American. Mm. You know, we're destroying the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And but there's also this aesthetic associated with lumber of like the blue collar worker, the woodsy, the outdoorsman.
Yeah.
And it's so incompatible with how the ecosystem is being destroyed.
100%. Well, and you hear in the radio, I'm not sure what scene it was in. Maybe we'll get to this.
I think it's this scene.
The get out your chainsaw.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's already you have this, you know, on the radio, the announcer is just like, "Hello, Lumberton. Da 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 da. Get out your chainsaws." Yeah. Like it's a beautiful day. It already adds to this kind of like, you're like, what? What's going on there?
Yeah, it adds to that decayed Americana. The cinematographer of this movie is Frederick Elms, and he achieves this really fresh, hyper-real look in the film, which is really gorgeous that you notice immediately in these opening scenes.
Oh, and I wanted to comment on that too. This film was shot on anamorphic lenses, which gives it this ultra-wide view of what's going on. You have so much frame to work with. And you really see like how David Lynch's ability to compose as a painter, as an artist, as a visual artist, it really shows through when you have this giant canvas to work with. He has like everything in these corners and these big places. It really plays into, you know, how this movie flows.
Yeah, Michael Atkinson said when you would watch this on VHS, a lot of the details would be cut out.
Yeah.
For that reason, because the film wasn't made to be watched on VHS.
One more production thing that I want to comment on.
Please comment on any production things you want.
This was a 12-week shoot, which makes me so fucking mad. Because now on an indie like this, if you have like a $10 million budget, $15 million, $20, $25, you'll get like 26 days. Which is like...
That's
like
insane.
26 to 33 days. You know, it depends on what you're doing, but like... In general, you get so little days now. And I was like, 12 weeks? Well, fuck. Like, you can actually flesh everything out. Like, you can spend a whole day on a few scenes. Like, and I think that video of David Lynch getting upset about, like, who gives a fuck how long a scene is? I'm like, he's right. And he came up in this era where you do get enough time to actually make art and to let things simmer and let things play out in different ways. You get to, like, really, like, marinate on the cinema, and you're just not given that space very often anymore. And it just devastates me. So I just wanted to mention that. I was like, 12 weeks and it's this American classic / this is part of the reason why I think it's so much fewer and far between to get like a truly unique, interesting kind of captivating abstract film.
These studios and producers just aren't taking chances like they used to on things like this. I mean, Dino De Laurentiis really took a chance after Dune was a flop because he believed in David Lynch so much as a filmmaker. So as we're kind of getting acquainted with this town, there's this noir flick on a TV in Jeffrey's home, right?
Jeffrey's home, yes. Indeed. His mother is watching the television.
And which is just so perfect because this film is decidedly a neo-noir.
Mm.
What defines a neo-noir? Well,
it's defined by...
A neo-noir is made after the classic noir era of the 1940s and 1950s. Neo-noir, as Frida Beckman says in her article for Cinema Journal, reconsidering the femme fatale in the films of David Lynch, neo-noir follows through on the moral ambivalence introduced in the classic noirs.
Mm.
So we immediately get the sense that something is off in this town. There's this this man who is watering the grass, and there's like a kink in the hose, and he sort of collapses, right? Like he's having a heart attack, and his dog starts like yapping barking at the water and drinking the water from the hose.
And then the baby waddling forward.
Yeah, there's this kink in the natural order of things.
Mm.
And it's funny, too.
Yes.
David Lynch has a good sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we get this crazy macro like shot of these bugs crawling, these beetles and ants crawling in the grass. And Lynch and sound designer Alan Splett. There's
Splett, such a good Splett. Sound design name.
There's they infuse this with this cacophony of machine noises and which Atkinson says lends the insects this awesome scale and menace.
Yeah, the industrial kind of the factory of bugs beneath us, the inner workings in the soil. Also, it really still ties into this, like, lumber, this industry, like, he's obsessed with industry, as many other filmmakers are.
Yeah, very Marxist of him.
Totally. A quick aside with that, the filmmaker Aki Kaurismäki is also obsessed with factories and this, like, incessant industry, and it just makes me think about, like, the all of these filmmakers that were born in a similar era. Aki Kaurismäki's it's not Icelandic, it's
he's
not
finished.
Dutch, it's right. Finnish, that's what it is. But yeah, these characters stuck in the grind of whatever society they're in. And it's also very beautiful. There's something very poetic about that. And I think that that ties into the natural world. And these beetles and bugs, truly the workers of the world.
And insects are little industrious beings.
Yeah.
And they're also telepathic.
Yeah. Right?
They're hive mind. We automatically like thrust into like the rot and decay underneath this idyllic landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Very much kind of like the crazed suburbia of early John Waters.
Yes, totally.
So, and John Waters loves David Lynch.
They're brothers.
There's this 100%. Great photo of them in the Big Boy.
in the Big Boy diner. Yeah, they really are like total brothers in that sense. I mean, the opening of this film could be very well be a John Waters film. The music,
yeah,
they
absolutely.
Love the same 50s Americana, the cars.
The filmmakers of this era were so fucked up by the 50s.
Yes. Truly.
Yeah, which we'll also talk about. I mean, the 50s as a theme is huge in this movie.
Mm.
So we're in this all-American town. We meet Kyle MacLachlan as Jeffrey Beaumont. He's wandering through town. He's kind of like in this field walking somewhere. He's this very all-American boy, but he's also wearing this suit and earrings. So is he like he might be an art school student like David Lynch, right?
He's like just getting to know himself. He's like, yeah, I'm wearing my fucking suit.
Yeah.
I got my little ear pierced, bitch. I'm back, girl.
So Jeffrey is visiting his father who's in the hospital, and he's got this crazy metal contraption screwed to his head.
Also, like, what happened to him? Like, what hit the hose? Doesn't I watched that scene like so many times? The opening scene where with the hose, and I'm like, does he get hit or does he just have like a? He starts grabbing the back of his neck.
I feel like he's having a stroke or something. I think it's supposed. I mean, obviously, we're not supposed to know.
It's unclear what happens.
Yeah, and Michael Atkinson says that this nightmarish hospital gadgetry matters more than the reality of illness or treatment because it's precisely how a child would perceive this scene.
Yeah.
There's something very uncanny in this hospital scene. Jeffrey comes back through the field that he's been walking through, and he finds a human ear that's covered in ants in the field.
It's already molding.
And it's molding. And there's this disturbing score that Badalamenti lets us know that something is very wrong.
Yes.
Here.
And then he picks up the ear with his bare fingers.
His bare fucking hands. Yeah.
I'm like, put it in your mouth, why don't you? And he puts it in a brown paper bag and he closes it very gingerly, which is always a detail I love when someone's very ginger with their hands.
Yeah.
I'm like, why are you sexually attracted to the ear? You're doing rare. Like, you're just so gentle with it, Jeffrey. Obviously, I'm a pervert, so that's what my mind goes to there. But I love how he handles that.
And the ear is like this portal. Like, Jeffrey is our Alice on the edge of a rabbit hole.
Mm.
And he goes to the police with his discovery, and he talks about how his family owns Beaumont's hardware store. So he's kind of like a almost like working class, but still middle class business owner. He's definitely not as wealthy as Sandy, just by the looks of their contrasting houses. Mm-hmm. But he's firmly in this middle class world. He's in college. He's a good boy.
The people in town know him. They recognize him. They're like, I know, you're the Beaumont boy.
Yeah.
Of the Beaumont hardware store.
So there's this scene that was deleted that was meant to show how good of a boy Jeffrey is, where he's on his way to the lavatory from a school dance, and he passes by a furnace room, and he, according to this is a quote from the screenplay, he's fascinated by a sight beyond in the darkness. And when he realizes that he's actually witnessing a rape in progress, and he approaches Michael Atkinson, says date rape, and I like refuse to use that term because I'm like, it's all rape.
Yeah.
And he approaches silently, doing nothing, watching, and then his steps are heard by the rapist, at which point he intervenes and says, hey, shithead, leave her alone. Don't force girls. So this was meant to be in the script, I think, to really show the kind of person that he is.
To show where his morality stands.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
And he's fascinated by it at first. You know, yes. He is watching. He's like watching through the bare wood beams.
Yeah, and we're going to, you know, I think that that's a huge theme in this film, is Jeffrey being fascinated by the darkness. There's one point where Frank Booth says, we're the same. And we're gonna talk about. So,
and I'm like, damn, I wish that this was the whole thing with this movie, that he did get final cut, but he had to make it under 2 hours, and he apparently cut the film down to exactly 2 hours and then deleted one frame. So it was 1 hour and 59 minutes and 59 seconds exactly. And I'm like, how tragic. There's so many cutscenes that you're like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense.
I wish that this film had been left in the movie, especially him being intrigued and repelled by it, I think speaks so much to his character. And
totally,
you know, kind of without it, it does give this film its kind of unreal quality. Like, we don't know Jeffrey that well. We learn about him through his experiences with Dorothy, but I just think you could have added something.
Yeah, that's true. I guess there's an argument there too for kind of this mystery about Jeffrey, of like, who really is he and where really it, because it is very unclear in as we progress. It's unclear where Jeffrey stands on certain things, whether it's artifice or not.
The cop is this very kind of like hard-boiled noir cop. He's like, that's a human ear, all right.
And the cop is Sandy's father.
Yes.
Which we don't know yet.
We don't
at this
know
point.
Yet that yet.
I love that scene when he's showing the ear. He's like, all right, let's see it. A human ear, all right? Like, yeah, he's just.
That's a human ear, all right.
He immediately shows his kind of uncanny self. And I'm like, what's your deal, brother? Like, when I was watching it, I was like, I never really noticed just how, like, he's kind of wry.
He's from a noir.
Yeah.
He's like a noir cop. Hard boiled.
Let's see the ear, you see?
Yeah, exactly. So we learn that the ear has been cut off with scissors. And we smash cut to this caution tape being snipped at the crime scene. Jeffrey is in his house, and his mother and his grandmother are there. Or no, it's not his grandmother, it's his aunt.
Yes. Yeah.
There's this proper American family, but in the noir, they're watching a man creeps up the stairs of a home, foreshadowing.
And we see the stairs in the background of their house too. It's that the scenes in the house to me are so noir.
Yeah.
Like these, and also these just like unsuspecting, very 50s looking women that are like, Jeffrey, where are you going? Are you staying out?
And he's like the man of the house now because his father's in the hospital.
Which, you know, brings us to the first Freudian kind of thing, concept of like the father steps down and then the boy becomes a man.
Yes.
and, you know, all that comes with that. Mommy? Question mark as we progress.
So Jeffrey leaves the house. He's walking the dog.
Well, there's a man walking a dog.
No, there's a man walking the dog.
But he's just standing there being very classically a Lynch background actor, where I'm sure Lynch goes up to this BG at some point, or his first AD tells the background actor, so you're going to stand here, right? And you're going to stare at the dog. You're not going to move. You're just going to stare. And the dog, these are the things that I love about Lynch, is like his background actors so often become like bigger characters, at least to me in the scene. It really like shows you what world we're in. Mm-hmm. It gives you, that kind of clues you into like, this is not the world that we live in. You know, like, yeah. I really love that.
Jeffrey has got this memory of the ear in the dirt. It's transposed over this night sky. And you have a note here that says, going in macro to the ear, it's a vessel or a portal to another world. Mm. And I said in my note that that happens in almost all Lynch films, like The Box in Mulholland Drive and The Closet in Lost Highway.
Mm. The Black Lodge in Twin Peaks.
Exactly.
Well, he progresses to that concept, I feel like. He really, like, he plays with the portal all the time, which also ties back into Wizard of Oz, where, you know, Dorothy is transported into this magical realm. And we also watched that documentary Lynch/Oz.
Yeah, which is on the Criterion Channel right now.
And I mean, the whole movie, that whole documentary is talking about Lynch's obsession with The Wizard of Oz and how it ties in and relates to almost all of his movies. And the concept of a portal is deeply important to him. Twin Peaks, The Return. My God, it's Portal City out there, which you haven't seen.
Not yet.
But guess what?
We'll be watching it.
We'll fucking watch.
The portal, and of course, because I'm me, I have to go there, is a vagina.
Yes!
Yes, we are the archaic.
Finally!
The archaic mother. I was actually surprised when I'm sure there's so much reading about Lynch out there that I just was not, obviously, like, I can't read all of it, but nothing I read talked about the portal as vaginal, which surprised me.
Especially for this one, because there's direct vag.
The ear is a pussy.
Oh, you're so right, mommy. You're always saying this.
So Jeffrey is arriving. He arrives at this house, which is the cop's house from before, Detective Williams, right? And he, you know, he says to Jeffrey, like, I was like you when I was your age. And it's kind of funny that he goes to the cop's house. It's kind of like, what's going on?
Well, he's like, he's immediately getting personal with it. He's like, you can tell, you're like, oh, you're like really interested in this. It's not, you know, he already sent the evidence over, but he's like, I got to talk to this guy one more time. Like, I can't just let it go.
He's getting invested. He, back outside, Jeffrey, out of the darkness, emerges. We hear this voice that says, are you the one that found the ear? And then Laura Dern as Sandy, who we find out is the cop's daughter, enters with this swell of romantic music. And that's when Lynch said he wanted her to enter like a wind coming in.
And it's beautiful. And she's like the classic picture of an all-American blonde white girl, you know. She's pure innocence personified in this moment. And she's all soft-spoken and sweet.
Yeah, David Lynch loves a blonde and a brunette juxtaposition, which is also from the noir tradition. There's like the dark femme fatale juxtaposed against the traditional love interest of the main character. And she's curious too. She's curious about solving this mystery with him. And I noticed too, her boyfriend is blonde, Mike, the football player. So suggesting that she might be on her own blonde brunette journey.
Oh my God. Oh, that's actually a really great point. Jeffrey is so Dorothy coded to her.
Yes.
And it all ties together.
So this is the first time we hear that quote. It's a strange world, isn't it? From Jeffrey, and they're talking about the singer in this apartment building. But Sandy is interested by her. There, as they walk, there's this creeping shot of the dark tree-lined street moving forward as if something's going to pop out.
Which is like this total horror trope. Like, you have a dark street, you're directly facing these two characters in front of you, you have this medium wide on these characters, and the music is giving you the sense that something's going to pop out. Like, and I, which is something I love about, like, because this is why I don't ever really classify Lynch as straight up horror, because he's very masterful about the way he portrays something that a horror film would. But then he ultimately almost never does the expected thing in that kind of trope, which is very cool to me.
So they walk to the Singer's apartment building, and she supposedly lives on the 7th floor, Sandy says. And there's this weird line where Jeffrey is, they walk by another house, and Jeffrey goes, "I knew the boy that lived there. He had the biggest tongue in the world."
And then he just, like, giggles. And they're like, yeah.
Yeah. It's so strange. Body parts.
Body tongue, parts.
Ear. Later, there's these vagina. Weird teeth on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
These disembodied parts. I don't quite know what to make of that weird line of dialogue, but it stuck out to me this time.
It makes me wonder if David Lynch knew a child
that had a huge tongue.
Yeah, or like if that's like a thing when you're a kid where you're like, "Oh, she's got a weird belly button," and like,
yeah,
in your mind,
it is very childlike.
Yeah, it becomes something bigger or something exaggerated.
We do get this scene next of Jeffrey at the hardware store, the Beaumont hardware store, and there's this blind black man named Ed. Mm-hmm. Who works at the hardware store, and they have this little moment where Jeffrey is like, "Hey, Ed, how many fingers am I holding up?" And Ed's like, "4." And he's like, "No, I don't know how you do that, Ed."
Yeah.
Such a weird scene. What do you make of that scene?
Well, I mean, what do I make of that scene? I wonder what Lynch is. I mean, I don't really question what Lynch's like meaning or purpose is, but I think it adds to, sometimes I think he just throws in a character he knows is interesting in some way. And something I love about that scene is that there's the other man behind the blind man, behind Ed. I believe the other man is also called Ed. And he's like, "How many fingers am I holding up?" And you see the other guy tap the guy's back, 1, 2, 3, 4. And he's like, "I don't know how you do that." And I'm like, "The other guy's right there. He already did it. Like, how did you not notice that? Oh my God." Like, so I think what I make of it is that it's just another way to portray who Jeffrey is in this town. And like, he's come up in this hardware store. He knows these men. He has kind of like playful interaction with these men that have clearly known him for a long time, that see him as a child in some way.
Yes, I think that's a really good point.
So I think it illustrates that. Him being a black man who's also blind and walking with a walking stick, I'm like, I really don't know if that's just David Lynch being like, more interesting, more something different, you know what I mean? I can't really tell what like the purpose of his identity might be.
Yeah.
Either way, I like the scene.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah.
So in this diner, this very classic diner, Jeffrey suggests that he and Sandy sneak into the apartment of this lounge singer. The diner as 50s Americana, so rich. And David Lynch himself loves a diner. He said, "I love diners. I don't like dark places." Even though his films are so dark.
I'm like, okay, closet queen.
Atkinson says, "The film's popularly noted collocation of 50s and 80s iconography, beyond its placing the film's action in a social and personal for Lynch void, suggests a sense of similarity between the two decades that directly addresses Lynch's much professed interest at the time in the Reagan administration, also in its way a socio-political tighten with one foot in each decade. In both cases, the 60s and 70s are contexts which do not need to be and are not addressed. In America, the 50s and 80s were both marked by surging affluence, stalwart conservatism, and rampaging conformism." So I think part of the reason we feel like we're between, like, we don't know if this is the 80s or the 50s, is because it is this kind of like 50s by way of 80s.
Yeah.
environment.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, all the cars in this movie are from the 50s, pretty much. Which is cool as fuck. It kind of gives this like James Dean vibe to Jeffrey in a way, which in some way I in my own world, I think about David Lynch thinking about himself and him being like, he's like slick back hair. He's like, I'm a little James Dean boy. And I feel a kinship with David Lynch for sure. He has elements of a boy girl himself because he's a little bit fabulous, like in his kind of like the things that he admires. And in like a character like the one that Michael Cera plays in the new Twin Peaks with his black leather jacket. Like there are things he thinks are cool, man. Like wild at heart, my snakeskin jacket is a symbol of my individuality. Like,
yeah,
I'm like, oh, he knows what he thinks is cool. And a lot of it comes back to this archetypal 50s cool man, which is like a greaser and like can become what you a bad
think
boy.
What you were cool. What we oftentimes we cling to what we thought was cool when we were kids.
Totally.
And that was probably the coolest shit ever when
right.
I was a kid.
Yeah.
So Jeffrey wants to involve Sandy in his plot, which there's some psychosexual tension there. He wants her to witness him. Mm-hmm. He says he's going to pose as a pest control guy, and Sandy can pose as a Jehovah's Witness to distract Dorothy. So he's going to come into her apartment under the guise of being pest control, and while he's in there, Sandy will come and pretend to be a Jehovah's Witness, and he'll creep around the apartment as the bug man and like look for clues.
Yeah, and the way he's getting her to go along with him is definitely through this flirtation, and he's being very convincing and gentle, and he's like, Sandy, you want to do this with me? He's like whispering, he's like hushed tones, he's like, this is so crazy. And I'm like, yes, classic college age man taking a high schooler along for the ride.
Totally.
And I'm in, by gods.
Yeah, I mean, something that has always been disturbing to me about Lynch is his portrayal of high school and teenage sexuality. Not like in a reactionary way, but it's so uncanny. I mean, it's like there's this aging of high schoolers that happens, especially in something like Twin Peaks.
Yes.
That it's just uncanny. It's very, it's off-putting.
And,
you know, Laura Palmer as like this teenage temptress, a sex pod. It's, it's the way that the men around her view her. Rather, that's in reality, she's a abused child.
Yeah. Well, and it's very clear that David Lynch has this pretty like vast understanding of the way that young girls in particular are abused and are treated and are like adultified in our society. And it's interesting that is a theme that comes up over and over again. And the abuse of women, period.
Yeah, I mean, it's how you would view high school girls when you were a kid.
Yeah.
As so old and mature. Mm-hmm. And it's that through that lens. So Jeffrey's got his little bug kit on. He's ready to roll. He goes to the Dorothy's apartment, and these apartments called the Deep River Apartments, in this kind of shady part of town. And in the original screenplay, an elderly woman confronts Jeffrey here, proclaiming, well, it's about time you came, suggesting the Deep River has a predictably serious bug problem. And Jeffrey was supposed to mutter and reply, that's a good sign. So I have a very long quote here from Michael Atkinson, but I thought that he just says this better than I could. So I was going to read the whole quote.
Yeah.
The outside stairs to the Deep River are a windy, desolate affair, resounding with the sub-industrial echoes of the place. What Pauline Kael said sounded like a heavy old animal that's winded. Upstairs, the tonal scheme of the Deep River building, a fungoid shitty green, and the expansive framing, Lynch was using a new telescopic wide-angle lens that takes in vast interiors without warping, jack the film's idiosyncratic visual substance into a new realm. Hardly the cartoon tableau from the beginning, nor the prosaically framed presentation of the suburban world outside. The Deep River is a world unto itself and possesses an altogether clammy, subterranean character. that so superbly invokes the actual experience of outdated, decaying, trashy American living spaces that your skin can crawl without even considering its subtextual gist. Deep River indeed. This is definitely Lumberton's Heart of Darkness, the reservoir of its guilt, hate, and despair. Moreover, it's an essentially adult environment. Children who live there get kidnapped and abused, and Jeffrey is from the start wholly out of his element. Less literally, it's a locus for sexual activity as perceived by a child, a place like a parental bedroom where grown-ups do unpleasant, unsavory, painful-sounding things to each other that we cannot fathom. Here is where Lynch's love for resonant details explodes. The Deep River is a secret closet overflowing with adult objects that can fill a naive kid with obscure nausea. Dorothy's velvet bathrobe and formless wig, the sleazy whorehouse furniture, the ugly short-circuiting fluorescent lights, even the dark, strangely unplant-like snake plants scattered throughout Dorothy's apartment, which Lynch may have known are one of the few common houseplants that can survive with next to no sunlight, perfect for the Deep River, and which were cheaply fashionable in the 50s.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful description of that. It really distills it down into like Dorothy's apartment really does kind of.
I hate this apartment.
It gives a trailer vibe.
It upsets me.
It's an upsetting place. It's supposed to be upsetting as well. And you don't ever see the full apartment. You never see her bedroom. You only see down the hallway into the bathroom. You see the living room. You see the kitchen on the left. And it's this like weird pink color. It's
mauve. And
yes.
It's like a motel room that you would be if your life was going really badly.
It's very dank.
Yeah. And so.
Darkness. That's a great comparison there.
Yeah.
The reservoir of its guilt, hate, and despair. Yes.
Yummy.
And it's fitting. Yummy. It's fitting that, you know, like that it's this dank, nasty space. We kind of come back to like where Deep River is, where the insects live. It's where the bugs are. He's coming to kill the bugs in this kind of metaphorical way. And it's also this comparison to like it being the closet of the town. Basically, it's fitting that Jeffrey is in the closet for much of his time in that apartment.
Yes. I remember seeing, when I saw this movie, that apartment just really upset me. Like, it's just, it's a place you're living if your life is not going well.
Totally. It's fucked up.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
And the sound in there, too. Like, the sound design is so empty. So important. Yeah, yeah, it's like this, like.
The despair.
This like an air conditioning.
Yeah.
Something humming. It's aggravating and it's disturbing. And I fucking love it.
It's great.
I love this part of it.
Yeah. So Jeffrey knocks on her door and Isabella, the singer, appears. Isabella Rossellini.
Rossellini.
As Dorothy Valens. Of course, Dorothy might be and probably is a direct reference to The Wizard of Oz. She's frightened and suspicious, lets him in to spray the apartment. And as he's spraying the apartment, a man appears at the door looking mighty mean, as you said, Car, in your notes. And Jeffrey is able to steal a spare set of keys while he's in there.
Which he doesn't even know if they will open the door to the apartment, really. But he's desperate at this point. He gets scared.
Yeah, let's talk about Dorothy's appearance a little bit. She's got this wig. And Lynch wanted her to have like hair like a country western star. But the wig was so wiggy that they have to call attention to the artifice of it. They have her pull it off in one scene.
Yeah. Yeah, it's this 80s like wig. It's as if Dolly Parton had a terrible blowout and was a brunette. And she has her very signature blue eyeshadow and her red lips, which I tried to emulate today.
She's got a red dress on.
She's got a red dress on. And as soon as she is in the apartment and Jeffrey, you know, is hidden in the closet, trying to get away so he isn't seen, we see her strip off the wig. We see her take off her dress. She's very vulnerable in her little negligee.
Yeah, she's faded glamour personified.
Yeah, she's got her little heels on.
Yeah, she's the artifice of it is very, you know, with the blue eyeshadow and everything is a little too off, too much. So, but we're gonna see more of her, of course.
And also just her posture in the scene, you see that she kind of, you know, she's like sunken. Her shoulders are low. She's not like
despair.
She's not exuding confidence here. She's just, she's in complete despair.
So Jeffrey goes back out to Sandy and, you know, he's like, she explains that she didn't even have to knock on the door because the guy who came in, who is this man in a yellow suit, the guy who came to the door, is that the man in yellow?
The man in the yellow suit? Wait,
the guy.
Oh yeah, it
and
is.
The guy who came to the door, and she was like, "It's just the bug man."
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. So it's this man in a yellow suit,
the yellow man,
and she says she didn't even have to do her part of the plan because he did it for her.
Right,
and Jeffrey's like, can I see you tomorrow? And she's like, no, I have a date with my boyfriend.
Mike.
Yeah.
Remember him? He plays football.
Right. And he's disappointed because she won't be able to help him sneak in again. And
that does that.
She loves Mike, but she really wants to fuck Jeffrey.
She's like, damn, you're so sexy. You're so involved in this mystery, sexy boy.
So is it next that they go to the slow club?
Yeah. So they end up going to the slow club the next night. You know, basically what happens is that Sandy tells him, I do have a date that night. And basically afterwards he's like, you know, that does that, blah, blah, blah. She's like, okay. As he's dropping her off, she's like, okay, I'll tell Mike I'm sick. But just to be clear, I love Mike.
Right.
And I'm not gonna fuck you. Basically. And he's like, yeah, sure. Boom, we're at the slow club.
Yes.
Bam. Great name of a club.
And why is it called the slow club, I wonder?
I don't know. I mean, a slow moving jazz. I don't know. Not sure, but I like where he's going with that. What's the bar in Twin Peaks called?
Oh yeah, what is the bar in Twin Peaks called? I don't
sound
remember.
Off in the comments. Yeah. I forget what it's called. He's always got great club names.
Yeah. Well, I think that the slow club makes a little bit more sense if you've seen some of the deleted scenes of some of the other performances at the club, which are just completely bizarre,
like weird rockabilly-ish.
Yeah, like, and it's some guy doing a bad comedy routine, and there's like a dog on stage.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's almost, I don't know why slow club makes sense for that, but it does. It's like this is slow motion reality.
Like, and if you like the clubs in David Lynch movies, if you enjoy the slow club and the performances that happen in any of the clubs or bars in David Lynch movies, again, I'm going to plug Aki Kaurismäki's films, specifically Leningrad Cowboys Go America or The Match Factory Girl. You'll have some beautiful psychotic Finnish performances. Le Havre, that movie includes this psychobilly, rockabilly French performer. Anyway, I tie those two together. I wonder if David Lynch is a Kaurismäki fan.
Mm.
In my head, there's the similar.
I know John Waters is.
Yeah. Americana obsession there, for sure.
So we get this weird conversation where Jeffrey's talking about beer he likes. And he's like, I love Heineken. And this is something he brings up a few times in the movie. There's this beer motif in the film, and Atkinson says it's used to symbolize class differences. So there's the open-minded semi-cultural Heineken lover, the authoritarian Budweiser disciple, like Laura Dern's father, Sandy's father,
classical American beer.
Yeah, and then the white trash PBR that Frank Booth likes. This comes up again and again in this movie.
Jeffrey going, you ever had a Heineken? And Sandy going, no, I haven't. He's like, great beer.
So funny.
I'm like, this is Heineken is to black coffee, for Blue Velvet, what black coffee is to Twin Peaks.
Yes, absolutely. So they see the blue lady. Miss Dorothy Valens, her performing. Atkinson says, down to her druggy cabaret act, she's an aging harlot and classic Jocasta figure, a forbidden yet frighteningly available mother figure seen purely in terms of seductive dread. At the same time, she's a pathetic victim, a wife and mother disoriented, whored and edged into sadomasochistic psychopathy by her circumstances and longing for a release through death.
Oof, aren't we all? Just kidding. What is a Jocasta figure?
Let's look it up.
Because I don't know what a Jocasta, when.
Oh, she's the wife of Laius, who married Oedipus.
The original,
the mother.
Horrid and edge into cinemastic.
So Jocasta is Oedipus's mother. Damn. So
yeah.
So she's singing Blue Velvet. You have a note here about the music.
Yeah, well, Angela was originally hired mainly to help arrange the music of the song Blue Velvet for Isabella to sing, but she had a really difficult time singing on key. So the arrangement is very simple and specifically catered to her singing. And then he ended up doing the whole score.
Yeah.
And I just love, I really enjoy her singing here because it's like,
it's not good.
It's bad, but it's giving, you know, local cabaret singer for sure. Like, and it also kind of adds to this, like, she's so trapped. What the fuck? Like, she's almost being forced to do this cabaret. You wonder if she's just being forced to do this cabaret act. Another, like, level of artifice, like, Frank's having her continue on in her daily life so that he can, you know, continue to do whatever. And then I also made a note of, God, she's so sexy. So true. We have to remember that Isabella Rossellini is one of the 20th century's most beautiful women, truly. As well as the 21st century.
Yeah, truly.
She's aging wonderfully.
Truly.
On that farm of hers.
Yeah, I mean, this scene is, when I first saw it, there's really, the best word I could think of for it is it's just so uncanny. It's disturbing. Like,
yeah,
it's this faded glamour, this sad figure, and her voice is so haunting.
Oh,
go ahead.
I was going to say this scene directly prefaces the scene in Mulholland Drive when they're watching.
With Llorando.
Llorando. Llorando. Llorando. And then she falls and you're like,
and that's,
she's not singing.
We'll save that for another episode.
I know, we should do another rendition. I'm sure everyone would love to hear that.
They drive to her apartment. She is introduced, we didn't mention, as the Blue Lady.
Yes.
And she's blue.
The Blue Lady. She's quite blue. Yeah. Her eyeshadow's blue.
Her disposition is blue.
Her soul is blue.
So as the show goes on, they drive to her apartment. Sandy is becoming more disturbed by the minute. She wants to help, but she's scared.
Mm-hmm.
They devise this plan that he's going to sneak in with the keys that he stole, and Sandy is going to honk 4 times to alert him that Dorothy is coming home. And she says, I don't know if you're a detective or a pervert. And he goes very childishly, that's for me to know and you to find out.
Oh, God. He's like, I'm such a bad boy. He's getting off on this. He loves it.
He's 100% getting off on it.
He's like, I'm literally such a man. And I'm like figuring it out. And it's like so awesome. And you're like following me and you're going to stay with me. Yeah. You know, which, you know, we all, he's kind, it's a lot of people have talked about this movie as being a coming of age story in many ways for both Jeffrey, Sandy, and it totally is this coming of age. It's this portrayal of someone who's very naive but is just so enticed by this world that he has no clue about, and he doesn't know how in over his head he is.
Yeah.
But he wants deeply to be a part of the mystery.
Yeah.
That's going along.
So we're back in the Deep River building. Her apartment is 710, which is a number that also appears in Twin Peaks.
It's true.
He goes to piss in her bathroom, which I'm like, so rude. And he pisses so much, he's like, Heineken. And he flushes the toilet. It's this loud ass flush. And he misses the warning honks that Dorothy is coming back. And he hears her enter and he goes to hide in the closet. And this is
back to that closet.
The famous, we're entering the famous section of the film.
Mm.
We get this view of her through the closet, this peeping Tom view. And it's also very childlike.
Mm.
You hide in the closet and watch as a little kid, hide and seek. She immediately takes off her dress when she gets in, and he's in this grip of, he's completely seduced at this point by the story here. I mean, but it hasn't become real to him yet.
Yeah.
It's still like a little mystery for him.
Yeah, he's excited.
Yeah.
He hasn't really seen any real danger either. He might have he might know that there's an air of danger, an energy of danger, but, and especially as like a man or a boy, I feel like your concept of danger is quite different than that of a girl. Like Sandy, it makes sense to me that she's so much more cautious and weary because, like, regardless of what's happened to you, you still are much more aware of the perils of this human wasteoid land as a child. Like, you know, you can see, you see a lot of that danger very early on, I feel like, as a little girl. Not that
so
little
true.
Boys don't, but, you know, it's just, I feel like that comes up a lot earlier for you know, people that aren't
yeah,
boys.
Of course, context, but generally, yeah, girls become acquainted with sexual violence much earlier.
Yeah.
So she gets a call on the phone where she, you know, is talking to who we know is Frank, but if you, your first watch, you wouldn't know. And she's calling him sir. She's asking about her little son, Donnie. She gets to talk to him for a second. She says, mommy loves you.
Well, and then when I realized watching it again yesterday, I was like, when she says, mommy loves you, sir, she's talking back to Frank.
Oh, yeah.
So she's like, is Donnie there? Donnie? I love her fucking voice so much. Oh, yeah. My God. And mommy loves you, sir. And it's she's back talking to Frank.
Yeah, so it's deliberately confusing.
Mm.
She's very scared.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath her couch, there's this picture.
A little box that she pulls out.
Yeah, and whereas there's this framed picture, and she's crawling on the floor like a caged animal.
Poor mommy.
She's tortured.
Abused, tortured mommy.
Yeah, she takes her wig off. She dramatically moves down the hallway with her hands on the walls, and she changes into this blue velvet robe.
Hmm.
So she gets the sense that something is wrong
in her apartment,
and she opens the closet. She has a knife. She grabs a knife from the kitchen, and she opens the closet, and she sees Jeffrey standing there, and she points a knife to his head, and she jabs him in the face, and she cuts him a little bit, and she's like, who are you?
Yeah.
She's shaking him down and getting his – she's like, what's your name? He's like, Jeffrey. And she's like, Jeffrey what? And he's like, Jeffrey nothing. And she's like, yeah, okay. And like takes his wallet. And she's like, what are you doing in here, Jeffrey Beaumont?
Yeah.
She's finally assertive. This is like one of the only scenes where she's really assertive.
Mm.
And she orders him to get undressed.
She forces him to strip immediately.
And she takes control of him. She's knelt down on the ground, and he's just in his underwear, and he's standing over her, and he looks very aroused but also scared.
Yeah.
And she pulls down his boxers, and he's making these little like gasping moans. It's very hot.
It's really hot.
Yeah.
I was just gonna say, like, because she's still holding this knife as she it quickly turns from like, She's threatening him. And then it's like this clear, she's like, oh, like this body, like you can see very quickly that she's taking control of the situation, this very vulnerable body that's not hers.
This scene is just what men want me to do.
I'm so sorry. God.
So
men should try being women.
They should try it. Have you tried it if you're a man?
I've tried it. as a genderqueer boy girl of girl boy experience, it's very different. You know, you can really be a girl while also being a girl who's a girl boy. You know, those who know, know.
Those who get it, get it.
That's right.
Yeah. And she's like kissing him and touching him. And she's like, do you like that? And he's like, yes.
Yes.
And then she's like, I'll kill you. And she's like, do you like talk?
Don't
like
touch me. Don't touch me.
I'll kill you. And she's like, do you like talk like that? And he's like, no.
He's so I'm like, scared. Then why are you hard, brother?
Right. But you get the sense that he does.
Yeah.
Like he says no, but he's so excited.
He's wavering. Mm-hmm. He's never experienced anything like that before. He's like, you know, his experience is clearly with girls like Sandy that are like, oh, Jeffrey.
And in the cutscenes, he has this whole other girlfriend.
Yes.
His college girlfriend.
I'm like, okay, slut. Like, he goes from college. He's got his college girl. He's like, she's like, you won't forget about me, Jeffrey. And he's like, of course not. I love you. And I'm like, oh, my God, you little weasel.
Yeah. But mommy is in full control right now, mm-hmm. using him like a sex object. Like, she's been used.
Yeah.
Wielding a knife. And Atkinson says, repeatedly forced into the role of masochistic mother whore by Frank, she ping-pongs between natural sexual warmth and violent habit when confronted with a normal, willing partner.
Mm.
I don't agree with him here.
Mm, what do you think?
This is why perverts need to analyze these films.
Yes.
I just think it's a little boring. Like, she just doesn't know what to do when she's confronted with a willing sexual partner. I think it's so much more complicated than that.
Mm.
I think that, and this is something I want to talk about when we get to these scenes, when she's, you know, starts to enjoy her abuse, mm-hmm. which feminist writers were really upset with at the time. I think she's forced into the role, but she also takes a pleasure in it. And I don't think it's that she's confused because she's confronted with a willing partner. I think that's doing a disservice to Dorothy Valance.
Totally.
I think she's more... I think that Dorothy gets a... not a bad rap, but she gets reduced. And when people analyze this movie, it's a bit reductive.
Yes. Well, I think that a lot of people don't necessarily have the insight into what... One, the experience of like a sexually abused person's perspective is, and I think there's a pitfall there of like, if you don't know people that have had those experiences, your immediate thought is, well, you're just this perpetual abused victim then, or like,
yes.
that peppers your entire.
And that's why I don't like that analysis.
Totally.
And I don't know, I don't know if Lynch is doing that or not. I think he's smarter than that, smarter than just having like, oh, she's been abused, so now that's all she knows is this abuse. I think that there is a part of her that is excited by the power that she has over him.
Oh, yes. Well, and he clearly, the analysis of when confronted with a normal willing partner, I'm like, well, Jeffrey's
he's
not exactly
willing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's being absolutely forced at knife point to do this, but he's enjoying it. So it's,
I think she's getting off on being the one in power.
Totally. And I think that that analysis hinges on the idea that like, well, he's a man, so he clearly wants it, or like he knows what he's doing. I'm like, this boy stumbles in here, he's getting fucking attacked, like, but he's like, oh, mommy.
But he loves it.
But I'm loving it.
But I'm loving it.
But I'm loving it. Do we think David Lynch is a pervert? Question mark.
I gotta believe on some level, yes.
She wore